Epistaxis, or nosebleeds, are very, very common. They happen to about 60% of people, but as common sense would allude to, most of these patients, they don't need to come see us in the emergency department. And with the many problems we encounter in the ED, a lot of our focus is on treating the problem, right? We want to make the bleeding stop. But the second thing we have to do is not just ask what the problem is and treat the problem, but why? Why is this patient having epistaxis?
Well put, Jess. You know, most bleeds start spontaneously, but they stop equally as spontaneously. So it's only the ones that aren't stopping, and they're usually pretty scary to the patients that come to us. So they're kind of a selected population. Most nosebleeds are just caused by simple kind of mundane things like dry air and nose picking.
Of course. Secrets out. Nose picking.
Yes, you heard me. Nose picking. And that's the fact. That's true. It's kind of funny, but it's true. But there are a few other more concerning causes, and there are some instances where a simple nosebleed actually turns out to be a life-threatening emergency. So we're going to talk about some of those other causes as well.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. If it wasn't already obvious, this is C3. Her name is Jess Mason. His name is Stuart Squadron. We're going to have the Super Ochos. We're going to be doing mucho nosobleedos in this month's C3 project.
You know, epistaxis is really the quintessential emergency medicine problem because I find it a bit analogous to an anterior shoulder dislocation. Mm-hmm. Even though an orthopedic surgeon is technically an expert on shoulder dislocations, they can do all kinds of things. They can take them to the OR. And the same is true of a really bad nosebleed. 99% of these are going to be within our domain. We're going to be the first and the last person to see these patients in many cases. And we, as specialty, have designed all kinds of tricks of the trade and instruments and stuff that help with this problem. And so it's very gadgety and it's very quintessential geeky us. MacGyvery, that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, MacGyvery, that's good.
You know, we've got a lot of tricks here. And so in this episode of C3, we're going to talk all about epistaxis, the history, the exam, a lot about the management, and we're going to talk about some of these particularly scary things that do come up once in a while, like a posterior bleed, and how you can navigate through those.
So before we get into all of that, let's just do a quick little teeny tiny bit of anatomy and pathophysiology. Let's get it out of the way up front so that we're all on the same page here. Epistaxis is typically classified as either anterior or posterior, and that's referring to the source of the bleed. Anterior epistaxis, by far, hands down, the most common. That accounts for over 90% of all nosebleeds, and it's usually unilateral. The source of an anterior nosebleed is Kieselbach's plexus.
Yes, Kieselbach's plexus.
Kieselbach.
I think we're saying that right.
Kieselbach?
Kieselbach.
But you know what? Just the easier way to refer to it is Little's area.
Little's area.
Okay, Little's area is the same thing. But please don't say Stuart Little's area. I don't appreciate that.
Okay, I won't.
Because that's rude.
Now I'm tempted.
Okay. Okay. Next.
So that's the anterior portion of the nares. It's right up against the septum. And think of it this way. If you were going to pick your nose, you stick your finger in your nose,
okay,
and that part of your finger that's touching your nose, mm-hmm, that's it.
I can't relate because I've never picked
my
nose.
Yes,
exactly.
I have.
Yes.
I admit it.
So what is the deal there? So there's that area there, that Kieselbach's plexus, is where there's basically arteries. There's three arteries that are supplying blood that kind of come together in a watershed area. It's kind of an anastomotic area where those circulations meet.
Yeah, I mean, it's the terminal branches. It's a bunch of terminal branches of the internal and external carotid arteries.
Right.
And then it's that watershed area. And that's where bleeds are the most likely to occur, especially if there's even just minor trauma, just, you know, like you couldn't wait to point out. And the most common being that chronic or acute digital trauma.
Yes. Oh, that's it. That's our euphemism for nose picking. Digital trauma.
Digital trauma.
Yeah. Oh, the patient sustained digital trauma and pressure was applied.
Self-inflicted.
Yes.
Digital trauma.
Excellent.
Hello, my name is Wilhelm Kieselbach, and this is a public service announcement for the people perpetrating the digital trauma. The digital trauma happens because you're picking your nose and not what you're supposed to be picking, which is the boogers in your nose, okay? You can pick your friends and you can pick your boogers, but if you pick your nose, you get epistaxis.
Paid for by the Kieselbach Institute for the Prevention of Digital Trauma.
Okay, now, just to talk about some of the more severe end of the spectrum here, the vast majority of nosebleeds in kids and in young adults are going to be these anterior bleeds. They're going to be accessible to us in the front part of the nose that we can squeeze and we can tamponade. But the concerning bleeds you get in older people, usually with a history of longstanding hypertension, and these are the so-called posterior bleeds. And you can't get to them. You can't see them without a scope. that looks back there. And so that's what makes them much more scary. And basically, those are the ones that at the end of the day, when bleeding isn't stopping, we're thinking, hey, maybe this is posterior. I don't seem to be able to tamponade or fix this problem. I can't see the blood where it's coming from. It's coming down the back of the throat. That's kind of the ultimate scary situation, is an uncontrolled posterior bleed.
And that was one of the things I think was confusing about this terminology, anterior and posterior. Where is this dividing line, and how do I know if it's anterior or posterior? But it turns out there is no clear dividing line between anterior and posterior.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're talking about the same watershed area, the same plexi. It's just whether they're in the part that you can see in the front part or in the back part. But you're right. It's the same anatomic watershed area that runs all the way into the back of the nose. It's just that we can't access it makes it that much more dangerous.
History and physical.
So let's go to the Super Ocho, the amazing residents at UCSF Fresno, and hear what they have to say. Does that sound good?
Absolutely.
Here I come to save the day.
That means that Super Ocho is on the way.
Okay, guys, it is a very, very, very busy day here at UCSF Fresno in the emergency department. We've got a lot to do, but first, let's go through who's on the team. Who am I working with today?
This is Jimmy, one of the second years at UCSF Fresno.
The real Jimmy, Dr. Jimmy McHugh. Who else?
This is John Ramos. I'm a PA resident at UCSF Fresno.
Cool. And?
This is Janelle, the second year UCSF Fresno resident.
Janelle Lee, Dr. Lee. All right. You guys ready to do this?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, let's rock and roll. So before we get going on the shift, let's have a quick chat about epistaxis. Does that sound good, you guys?
All right.
Yep. Cool.
Okay, let's do it. Let's start with the history. Like, what are some of the things you basically just want to know when you're trying to get the history from a patient who's bleeding out of their nose?
Did this person get hit in the face? Was there trauma to the face?
That would definitely be important. What else?
Are they a nose picker?
Yes. Do you flat out ask that?
Do you... I have, actually, yeah.
Yeah?
People will say, well, they'll try to hide and like, oh, I may have actually dug around.
A little bit of it.
A little bit.
What are some other things you'd want to know? So we talked about trauma, whether it's, socked in the face or digital trauma. What else?
Are they on blood thinners?
That's a good one. Okay. Which ones in particular do you want to know about?
The Coumadin, the new ones like Apixaban, Pradaxa, Eliquis, Xarelto, all those things that are still changing.
Yeah, I've asked about aspirin too. They're antiplatelets and they tend to also bleed more easily. I haven't had a case though yet with aspirin being a problem, but I can imagine that would be a big problem.
What else would be important to know on the history?
They have any blood dyscrasias,
yeah.
Bleeding disorders. Mm-hmm. Or, if they have dry mucous membranes, did they turn the heater on really high? So just getting the general idea, like what season are we in, that sort of thing is helpful too.
Do they have high blood pressure?
So that was pretty good, huh?
Yeah,
so
these guys
did a good job.
Yeah, if you want to learn what to do, you go to Fresno. There's no question.
That's right. So I think they touched on all the main things. So just to reiterate, emphasize the importance. Bleeding disorders, super important. Actually, blood dyscrasias.
Dyscrasias.
Yes.
I like that word she used.
Yeah, she phrased
I wonder if she
it better
can spell
me.
It. Dyscrasia.
Emily, your word is dyscrasia. It's the abnormal or disordered state of the body or of a bodily part. Dyscrasia.
Are there any alternate pronunciations?
Yeah. Dyscrasia.
May I have the language of origin?
Just spell it.
D-U.
Wrong. D-Y-S-C-R-A-S-I-A. Idiot. Bye.
It's a tough one, but it just means bleeding disorder, basically, right?
Right, right. So any bleeding disorder, of course, anticoagulation, we want to know what agent they're on. We'll get to more of that discussion in a little bit. And then, of course, as Janelle referred to, nose pickers, especially if you're picking your nose in the desert in winter where it is low humidity, that would be the biggest risk factor.
That's a way to ask the question, too.
Yeah.
Do you do it in the desert in the winter?
Highly relevant.
Okay. What else?
Well, we want to know just the usual questions. Like if this was someone with vaginal bleeding, we would quantify the bleeding. We want to know how much and for how long. What they tried at home. Did they try anything to make it stop? Is this a recurrent problem or is this a first-time bleeder? And we want to know if there's other risk factors that makes them more likely to have a bleed, such as intranasal steroids.
Yeah, that's
that
a big
a lot
one,
of
actually.
People are on.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's illicit drugs like cocaine is a big one, obviously. Huffing, which is solvent abuse. Those things make people very prone to nosebleeds.
Mm-hmm. And then other medical problems that they have, not just the blood dyscrasias, but if they have liver disease or kidney disease or anything other than hematologic disease.
Yeah, and I actually want to point out one specific kind of nasty syndrome that afflicts a lot of people. people, which is Osler-Weber-Rondeau syndrome. Mm-hmm. Some people say call it Osler-Rondeau-Weber. It's got different orders and stuff. Mm-hmm. But basically, the better name for that is hereditary, because it runs in family, hemorrhagic, because it bleeds like stink, telangiectasia, so or HHT. And that's basically a condition where they can have vascular abnormalities in their mucosa. They can be anywhere through the nose into the parts you can't see. They can be other places in the body as well. And it's really, really a tough, tough condition to manage. They have constant nose bleeding. And it usually takes just like a multidisciplinary team of plastic surgeons and ENT surgeons to deal with this. They actually have to excise parts of their mucosa. It's like it becomes a surgical dilemma. And so just all I would say about that is if the patient has that history, you should probably get your consultant involved earlier rather than later. And the other thing is if they do keep having nosebleeds and there's no good explanation, consider that that might be what's going on and they probably need a full workup and endoscopy. Okay, so that's kind of our wish list, right, for all the things that we would want to ask on history. Real life, often, you know, it's hard to get every single point.
So let me jump in here and do a bit of emphasis. I'm not sure I really need to, but boy, you know, I've got to do something for my paycheck. And it goes like this. You've got the patient and they've got nose bleeding. You want to start sort of asking some questions about how much, how long, how frequent does this happen? And then you want to find out if they've got risk factors for it. And don't ask if you pick your nose. You need to say, how often do you pick your nose? How much do you pick your nose? Because like death and taxes, ladies and gentlemen, nose picking is universal. And you've obviously got to ask about things like, do you have a bleeding disorder? Do you take any medications that can cause bleeding? Your aspirin, your non-steroidals, your anticoagulants, for example. But don't forget the intranasal steroid, even the intranasal alpha blockers like oxymetazolone and stuff that people use a lot. These can dry you out as well. And then there's the illicit drugs, and cocaine is the big one. Now, this is a bit confusing because we actually can use cocaine in the emergency department to stop bleeding. But if you use cocaine chronically over time, then all that alpha constriction that occurs in your nose can actually result in you destroying your nasal septum and giving you these big nasty plaques that bleed a lot. So we can use it for treatment, but if you use it too much, cocaine users, then your nose can collapse and it's very bad. And then other medical conditions that might make you bleed, like liver disease and kidney disease and this kind of stuff. And we've got to think about, you know, as we said, sort of the hemophilia and the von Willebrand's disease, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasias. You got to think about nasal neoplasms and the Osler-Weber-Rondeau. So if you've got somebody who's got nosebleeds recurrently, you might be the first person to work out that there is some structural slash blood dyscrasia thing going on if there's not an obvious nose-picking drug cause. But now let's go to the Super 8, because they're about to go see a patient. And the thing I love most about the Super 8 is that although they are super, they are so rarely ocho.
Algorithm and workup.
John, do you want to see this patient with me?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, cool. Could you tell me how old you are?
78.
And what happened to you that brought you to the ER?
I woke up with a bloody nose about 2 o'clock this morning.
Okay.
And I jumped out of bed, but I have to use a walker, so I didn't even use my walker. But I woke my daughter up, and it was just gushing out of me.
How much blood?
Oh, quite a bit. It was just gushing.
And how long did this go on for?
Oh, about 20 minutes.
Okay. So what was it that scared you about this nosebleed?
Well, I'm on blood thinners. I have a blood clot in my lung. And so they had told me that there's a possibility of nosebleed.
What's the name of the blood thinner that you're on?
Oh dear, my daughter has the box. She told them what it was.
Do you think it's called Coumadin?
No, it's not Coumadin. I inject it.
Okay. Is it Lovenox?
Yeah, I believe that's it, yeah.
Okay. So how long have you been on Lovenox?
About 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay. And this is the first time you've had any bleeding?
Yes.
Okay. And you don't have any known problems with bleeding disorders that you know of?
No.
Okay. Anyone in the family have bleeding disorders?
No.
Okay. When you were at home, what did you try to make the bleeding stop?
Well, holding my nose, putting pressure on my nostrils.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's actually talk about our algorithm, our stepwise approach on how I approach epistaxis.
Okay?
Starting with the primary survey.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably one of the most important parts of this segment, which is that if the patient is in shock, this is something that people sometimes don't recognize immediately. They're like, oh, it's a nosebleed. They need to go in the nosebleed room.
Right.
If they're in shock, if they have hemorrhaged out so badly that they're hypotensive, altered mental status, that type of thing, they need to go into a resuscitation bay. That's one of the first things I say off the bat. And you can deal with all the nosebleeding stuff along with your general resuscitation.
Yes, totally agree. Now, I want to make sure everyone who listens to this has at least that basic approach of all the steps they're going to go through. But before we go into great detail of each step, just tell me your overall algorithm steps 1 through 8.
Okay, absolutely. Step 1, the primary survey. Step 2, pinch the nose. Step 3, clean out the boogers. I know that's you like that one, right? Clean out the boogers.
Mm-hmm, I do.
Okay,
yeah.
Step 4, analgesia and sedation.
Mm-hmm.
Step 5, find the bleeding site, if possible. Step 6, anterior packing. Step 7, posterior packing. And the most interesting step, 8, where are your friends?
Where are my friends?
And that's basically, you need help at that point and you're looking for friends.
And we're looking for either our ENT friends or our OMFS friends.
And possibly interventional radiology, sometimes even general surgeons, because it could be in a smaller community an instance where you need all hands on deck.
Well, you've got a friend in me.
Now, let's say that this patient is not that resuscitation patient who
needs... Like most of them aren't.
Yeah, the vast majority are not. We want to do a physical exam, and there's certain things we're specifically looking for, but you don't want to hear me tell you about the physical exam, right?
No, I want to hear the residents. Let's hear them.
So epistaxis patients are kind of difficult to examine, right?
They've got
blood coming out of their nose, or they're pinching their nose. It is hard to get a good exam of the nasopharynx. So what are some things that you do to try to improve your odds of actually getting a good physical exam?
If we can have them blow their nose out to kind of dislodge some of that blood and clot so we can have a better look. Also checking the back of the oropharynx to see if I can see any bleeding from there as well.
So how do you actually get that good look? What do you need?
Otoscope with a speculum.
Yeah, so what are you using that for?
You're trying to look in the back of the nose. You're trying to see the nasal mucosa.
Right, so you're using it as your light source probably,
yes.
Right? You know, and not a lot of ER doctors carry around headlamps. So an otoscope is a good light source, or maybe if we're in an ENT room or some of the other rooms where you can pull down a light or bring a light into the room, that's helpful. What else?
We have those, I don't remember what they're called, but they are a nasal speculum, I think, in the kits. We usually have those. Those are really helpful too.
I'd get suction set up at the bedside just to help with your view.
Perfect. Okay, so we've got suction, we've got our nasal speculum, and we have a light source. And now we can hopefully see. So what are we looking for when we look in the nasopharynx?
So a source of that blood?
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Other than just looking for where is the bleeding coming from, we always want to ask the question, why is this patient bleeding? So what are some things that we could look for on exam that may explain why the patient is having epistaxis?
Deviated septum patients have a higher incidence of epistaxis.
Yeah, that's right.
You want to look for masses because cancer and polyps can be a reason for a patient to bleed.
John, were you able to get an exam?
Yeah, I was. It was very difficult because there was a lot of blood in there, but I did not see any masses. There was just a lot of blood.
So that's a lot of good stuff there. They bring up a lot of the really important points of the initial management of your bread and butter nosebleed. I just want to emphasize a few points. First thing is, and I can't emphasize this enough, you've got to be able to see what you're doing. So this discussion about the light sources is not just an academic discussion. It's really, really germane to actually seeing what's going on here. And I would say that if on your initial approach, you're not able to see up this nose, you know, all you see is blood, you really shouldn't be going too far down that pathway without getting your analgesia and your vasoconstrictors on board in that nose. And a lot of people wouldn't waste any time. They wouldn't even look before doing that. When the patient is in that position with that in a sort of a sniffing position, remember that you're going to be applying the nasal speculi in the nose. The specula is superior inferior.
Key point.
You want the curvy parts, the semicircles, to be one superior, one inferior, because if they're lateral, you're going to be pushing on the septum, you're going to be irritating the area. You don't want to be doing that. And the other major, major point is you're looking straight back.
Mm-hmm.
The nasal cavity does not go up. If you take a cross section of the head, you see that it goes straight back. And so you're looking in the inferior superior position with that speculum. You got a great light source. You're looking in there. And if it's just all you see is blood situation, that's when you're going to introduce your soaked gauze, your soaked pledgets that are going to have two ingredients, something to numb the mucosa up and something to vasoconstrict so that the bleeding at least slows down so you can see something. Those are the two elements.
So at this point, you've already done your spray, your oxymetazoline spray, and you still can't get a good view. And that's when you're putting in your soaked pledget?
I don't want to be too dogmatic. There's a lot of different ways to skin this cat. And so for sure, some practitioners would say, listen, don't even bother taking a look until you spray some vasoconstrictor or some lidocaine up there. That's fine. You can do that approach. But for a lot of people, especially if it's a really significant bleed and you can see that it's obviously kind of pouring out there, you're going to want to do this all at the same time. You're going to want to put your speculum in. You see lots of blood. You're going to be putting the soak pledgets in. And then you're going to go back to the first steps, which is have the patient continue to pinch with those soaked pledgets. And then after about 15 minutes of these medicines to work in the mucosa, then you can go back in and start at the beginning where you're going to look in again and see if you can find the bleeding point.
Another thing that you mentioned, and I want to emphasize how important it is the sniffing position. So this is not someone who you want laying supine with a bunch of blood going down the back of their throat.
Not unless they're intubated.
Yeah. You want them sitting up. You want them protecting their airway. You want them in sniffing position. And it's also going to help give you the best view when you put the nasal speculum in.
Yeah, and I really love what one of the residents was saying about the other sources of bleeding, cancer, polyps. You know, there's the look part of our specialty. Mm-hmm. You've got to look at things. And so sometimes you have no choice. You know, it's desperation. All you see is blood and you're just lucky to stop it. And it might be, you know, and someone else is going to look at that obviously down the road. Asian patients in particular have this very increased incidence of nasopharyngeal carcinoma. Mm-hmm. That's important to pick up if it's right in front of you.
And it would potentially change your management if you saw a big bleeding mass. The last thing that I would want to do, unless it was the last resort, is shove something right up against it that can cause more trauma and more bleeding.
Yeah, it's going to be basically buying you an urgent consult with the ENT when you see something like that.
So you look in the nose, you're seeing just lots and lots of blood. You're looking for a source. Are there any clues to help us figure out if this is an anterior or a posterior bleed?
Well, basically, if you're getting down these steps to the point where you're able to see something, okay, so I'm assuming that you've got this little cleaned out and you've got some analgesia sedation on board, if necessary, and you're taking a good look, you're really looking carefully in that littles area for a bleeding point. You're looking for either blood that's actually freshly coming out or areas where it was obvious that blood did come out, little scabbed areas. And you'll often see that. And if you do see that, we know that there's a therapy to go for. It's an anterior bleed. And the therapy options are basically you can cauterize it chemically, electrically, or even just applying an ointment, like an antibacterial ointment, has been proved to be quite effective. But it is reassuring once you see that bleeding point because you know that it's probably coming from an anterior source.
So what if there's a lot of blood coming out, but I just cannot see a source?
Yeah, okay, well, this happens all the time. And basically, it's still probably an anterior bleed, but you can't see the bleeding site. And that, again, that happens all the time. And what we do is we just kind of go down our stepwise approach and we pack the anterior nose, assuming that it's somewhere in the anterior area, and see what happens. And that's sort of the essence of the algorithm. If it stops there, you can assume it was an anterior bleed and you're going to go forward with the management. If it doesn't, if there's still blood coming down the back of the throat after you've packed the anterior part of the nose, then you come to the conclusion that it's probably a posterior bleed, one of those more serious ones.
Okay, so that was a great overview of the initial approach and management, which we're doing at the same time. We're doing that in parallel. So the first question, is this a resus patient? Is this someone we're bringing into the resus room because they're hemorrhaging and we need to think about managing their airway? Or is this someone who we think is stable and can go in the ENT room and we're getting our light source and suction and our nasal speculum and getting our exam at the same time we're trying to intervene to stop the bleeding with vasoconstrictors and with anesthetic for the patient? So that's great. Another thing to think about is labs. Do we need them?
Before we do labs, let's do summary of the physical examination kind of management part. Now, you can distinguish yourself as an excellent clinician by not being afraid of epistaxis. I've seen generations of residents, nurse practitioners, PAs, even attendings, who are afraid, who don't have an approach, who see an epistaxis patient, and you just see them like, oh no, I really am not sure what to do for these people. And they can't offer more than just saying, I'll pinch your nose. And by the way, where do you pinch your nose? You don't pinch the nose on the bony part of the nose, but on the squishy part of the nose. And when you get them to pinch it, you say, hold it for 10 minutes. When I see people pinching the bony part of the nose, I'm like, well, why are they doing that? And you see it all the time. But anyway, let's get back. So Here's my quick approach, sort of tag teaming from what they've said. I like to get all of those boogers out there. So you get a big tray or you find a big trough with the water running and you just say, blow those boogers out. I can't do much until I get them all out. Once you get them all out, then I like to spray in something like oxymetazolone, which is an alpha blocker and constricts things down. If you've got cocaine, put in a few cocaine pledgets in there. That's all good. And then you need a good light source, you need a good chair, and you need a patient who's not freaking out. So that often means a little bit of sedation so that you can get in there and get a good look. If you can find the bleeding point, then you can cauterize it. If you can't find the bleeding point and you've got a good look and you've got a good light source and you're looking back in there, then you might have to try packing. Anterior nasal packing. There's lots of different devices now, various tampon devices and stuff which work really well. Put them in bilaterally. If that doesn't work, you might be dealing with a posterior bleed. And if you're dealing with a posterior bleed, then you might have to put in posterior devices. Now we have these balloon devices and they can work very well. You're going to try and work out which side it's bleeding from and you're going to put in one of these balloon devices. If you've got somebody who's bleeding a lot, particularly if it's posterior bleeding, you might have to get ready to deal with the airway. You might have to intubate this patient, call for help, do your stuff, because it can get really, really nasty. So let's get back to labs. But for the vast majority of patients, a good light source, no fear, sticking something up there to stop the bleeding and doing a really good exam is key and making the patient feel as comfortable as possible. Oh, so key. Let's talk labs.
Do you think that the patient needs any lab tests?
That is a great question. I haven't seen enough nosebleeds to know if she needs lab tests, if she's anticoagulated, although I'm kind of wondering if we know she's anticoagulated, like she's taking her medications, do we really need it? But I don't know if that really changes why she's bleeding from her nose.
So with the lab tests for epistaxis, certainly not every patient needs labs. In fact, many patients don't need lab tests at all. But if there's a lot of bleeding, you know, some things that you can think about if you're really concerned would be a CBC, check to see if they have a significant blood loss. And also you may want to take a look at their platelets if there's anything else on a physical exam that's concerning for thrombocytopenia. If they're on anticoagulation, then it would be helpful to see, particularly if they're on warfarin, if they are therapeutic.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's important to emphasize here, you have to have a reason to draw labs on these patients. The vast majority will not need labs, even if they're on Coumadin, if it's a minor bleed that's well controlled and they've been getting their follow-up and they know what their INR has been, that kind of thing. You don't have to necessarily repeat those things. It's when it starts getting more severe or you start worrying, ooh, I wonder if this person's got leukemia. I mean, this is a lot of bleeding in a patient who otherwise doesn't have a reason to bleed. Then you can start thinking about some of those other labs.
They're covered in petechiae or they're jaundiced.
Exactly.
Other
they've got
things to think
ascites
of.
And yes, exactly.
Right.
Management, part one.
So we did sort of a brief overview of the management going through your algorithmic approach, but let's get into some more detail about the management options. And you know what? Let's hear it from the residents.
So what have you tried so far?
So far, I had the patient blow their nose, and then I sprayed oxymetazoline and had the patient apply pressure.
So that's perfect. That's the perfect first initial intervention to try. Now, we want to be ready for a backup plan in case this doesn't work. So what are we going to do? What is in your mind to try next if she's still bleeding after 15 minutes of pinching her nose?
In my mind, the next steps are going to be another way to stop the bleeding. So that could be something like silver nitrate. That could be liquid cocaine. Ultimately,
Do you have a good supply of liquid cocaine?
Yeah, in my backpack all the time.
Okay, just
no, I do not have a supply of that. I think that the end goal, like the last resort, is going to be nasal packing.
So, hey, Janelle, Jimmy, let's go back to you for 1 second here. So what are some other things that are on your minds of things that we could try if this nose is still bleeding?
The cocaine is also on there. We're lucky at our facility that we're able to get it from pharmacy if we need to.
There's also TXA that we can try. I usually just go for packing if it's really that bad.
That was great. So just like what John said, he had the patient blow her nose and then spray some oxymetazoline and pinch her nose. That is the first initial attempt for the patient who's not hemorrhaging to see if you can get the bleeding to stop. But if it's not going to stop, then we have to progress stepwise through that algorithm that you laid out right at the top for us, Stuart. And one of the steps in there that is optional is to see if there's something that we can cauterize. So you take a look. If you see a bleeder, then you know that you have a target. You have something that you can try to cauterize. And silver nitrate is one of the methods that we can do this by.
Absolutely. And, you know, silver nitrate basically causes a chemical burn. And that's a way of stopping the bleeding. Ironically, when there is a lot of blood there, it doesn't work as well. It really works when you're able to kind of get that mucosa to stop bleeding. So that's just, it's as dry as possible because it's always a little bit moist. Mm-hmm. When that silver nitrate makes a chemical reaction with that mucosa, it's what does the cautery.
So a couple things to keep in mind with silver nitrate cautery. Number one, you just told me it's a burn. So I'm going to assume that probably hurts.
You got it. It does indeed hurt. So, I mean, to use this without first using some topical anesthetic, either
that's barbaric.
Either it's the cocaine that your residents seem to be so interested in or the lidocaine, that's kind of like has to be in there because
it's
got to
be done first.
Yeah.
And then the second thing to keep in mind is what's classically taught about cautery. If you're going to do it, you only get one side of the septum.
That's right, because especially with their, and there's, it's interesting, I didn't actually realize this, there's actually extremely potent and less extremely potent versions of silver nitrate, and the really potent stuff that's, I think it's 90% or something, causes double depth of burns. You can actually burn right through the septum and people can have a hole. So the last thing in the world you want to do is make these burns on both sides of the septum. That's mm-hmm. the thing that they tell you to avoid. The other real finesse thing about this is that if you go directly for the bleeding point, often you make it worse with the trauma. The best way is to go in a circumferential way around the bleeding point, cutting off its feeding vessels, and then bullseyeing in the middle. That seems to be the most effective way of cauterizing with silver nitrate.
So you're circling in before you come in for your landing.
For the kill, yes. Or just circling around the lesion, and once you see that it's stopped bleeding, ceasing and desisting, because you don't want to use any more silver nitrate than you absolutely need to use.
Another thing that's mentioned in all the textbooks and the review articles is electrical cautery.
Yeah, listen, for many, many years, this was the mainstay of treating these things. And I just have a problem with any procedure that has a chain of metal that starts with the inside of my nose and ends at a wall socket.
Yes.
Patients rightly get very nervous when you pick up the electrical cautery. And it can definitely be more effective than the silver nitrate in that it can burn through a little bit of blood and actually cause the burn that you need to stop the bleeding. But I don't know. I don't use it anymore. I think it's a little bit medieval. It's definitely an option, but it's one that more often the ENT is going to be using than you.
So cautery really only works if you see a specific area that's bleeding. If you don't see anything bleeding, there's nothing to cauterize, right?
Yeah, basically you got to see something bleeding, a bleeding point, or something that obviously was bleeding. And that's usually like a nipple sign. You see mm-hmm. a little nipple, you see a little tiny bit of an eschar. Mm-hmm. Those are the signs of that blood was there. So one of the really fascinating things that's come out in the literature studying nosebleeds is that whether or not you actually see a bleeding point and choose the chemical cautery or electrical cautery strategy, you can also, in those cases, just use ointment. Often bacitracin antibiotic ointment is used, even Vaseline. And if you use those instead of the cautery, the outcomes are about the same. And so whether it's kind of a little confusing, but it's an acceptable alternative when you see or whether you don't see a bleeding point to just use the ointment. And some patients that are really skittish about you sticking things up there, that's a legitimate strategy.
So what are you doing? You're taking a Q-tip and smearing it in? You're letting them digitally apply it?
Yeah, exactly. You basically, either one is acceptable.
Hey, so it's been about 15 minutes and she's still bleeding.
Okay, so working through the algorithm, then what do you want to do next?
So I looked in the nasopharynx and I could not see an area of bleeding. So I think that the best next step is to do some anterior nasal packing.
Great. Okay, yeah. I mean, if you can't see a specific area that you can cauterize, then
there's nothing to cauterize.
There's nothing to do there. So yeah, great. Let's try an anterior nasal pack.
All right, so let's talk about nasal packing. And first of all and foremost, anterior nasal packing, because that's going to be the majority of cases are going to stop with anterior packing. So just to be clear, this is a scenario where you've gone through all the initial steps, you've cleaned out the boogers, you've taken a look, you've anesthetized it, you're looking for something to do, and all you're seeing is blood, and you're like, I got to stop this. And that's when you start your anterior packing. That just sort of sets it up. So one thing, in addition to the local anesthetics that we should mention, is this is very frightening for people, and there are some patients that you're going to need to use something systemic. You mm-hmm. might need to use a little bit of systemic opioid or benzodiazepine. Make sure that you're using the appropriate monitoring equipment. If you're going to do that, you might even need to hang on to these patients if you're going to be giving them actual systemic medications.
But this is painful. This is an uncomfortable process.
Right. I mean, if it means giving a patient post-traumatic stress disorder from sticking things up their nose and hurting them, then you have to consider that. It might be the best thing to be a little more careful and deliberate. Now, in the old days, the way that you packed a nose was manually. You would actually take this long, long packing strip and you would piece by piece, fold it into the nose. And the thing that was always so incredible about that, Jess, was how much room there is mm-hmm. in the back of the nose. It's a huge area. And it would take many, many meters or feet, if you will, yards of this tape, stacking it in layers to actually occlude the whole space. So you're tamponading, and that's what you're doing here, tamponading that side of the nose.
It also kind of sounds like it would be a grotesque Mary Poppins moment to remove that.
Yes, exactly. Like you're basically pulling...
The magician pulling the scarves.
Yes, and they just never stop
never
coming.
Never stop.
And that's exactly what it was like.
And they change colors too on the way out.
Yeah, just, because they get like less magic. And less red, or more and more red, depending on how much blood is on them. Exactly. So that is the history of it. And I think everyone needs to be reminded of what we had to put up with. And now there's so many proprietary products out there that make this so much easier. And they're all some variant on the theme. They're all basically some form of a tampon. And some of them are coated with hemostatic agents. Some of them are coated with different polymers. And there's all kinds of brands out there. But the theme is all the same. These things are inserted straight back into the nose. They have some sort of a string or applicator in the end that lets you know that it's in there, and it usually just comes out just a little bit past the nasal margin. And they're a miracle. They work so well because they expand and they tamponade the bleeding. They work in the vast majority of cases.
When you are inserting whatever anterior pack you're using, I think it's helpful to actually picture that drawing, that netter drawing of the nasopharynx and the turbinates. And you want to basically try to slide it along right below the inferior nasal turbinate.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone always makes fun of me because sometimes they come in like small, medium, and large, these different products. And everyone's like, well, for me, I would use this one. But for you, Dr. Squadron, a larger one would be indicated. I want you to know that we all have big nasal spaces inside.
Right.
Whether we have big noses or not, okay?
It just matters what's on the inside.
It does matter what's on the inside. But in all fairness, there are some patients that do require two of these devices to actually totally occlude the space. And you have to kind of play it by ear a little bit. Of course, you know what you're going for. You're going for a patient that's reasonably comfortable whose bleeding has stopped.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to mention there are a lot of products out there. We're trying to avoid using name brands of all the specific ones. But the bottom line is, whatever one you're using, you need to look at the packaging and the instructions on that, because some of them require different things. Some of them you have to soak in sterile water before you insert them. Some of them have slightly different instructions. So you want to, and the length to which you insert it. So you just want to be aware of exactly what product you have and make sure you're using it correctly.
You know, one of the concerns with a lot of these products comes on the back end when you're taking them out. And there's been a lot of criticisms of some products, the earlier ones especially, that when they're coming out, if they don't have the nice coating on them, if they're not dissolvable or absorbable to some extent, they kind of rip off the epithelium.
Ouch.
And so there are some products out there that are more like a foam type product that you insert into the space and it expands and it kind of degrades on its own. And there's some variants of these products that might be a little more patient friendly, I would say.
And pretty much all of these are going to have some type of a string that's coming on the outside of the nose so that you can remove it when the time comes. And it's important that you tape that up to the patient's cheek. You know, you don't want that going in their mouth. You don't want it going all the way in their nose.
And it's no joke. When you're talking about sticking something up someone's nose so far back that, you know, drip, 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 you know, blood is going to be coming down the posterior airway. And that's what we're talking about here. It's no joke. If that patient, for example, is elderly, has COPD, has some heart failure, that can be dangerous. And so if you're in a situation like that, when you're putting the packing in, you do stop the bleeding, keep in mind that older, more vulnerable patients should be considered for observation after this procedure.
Even with an anterior pack?
Absolutely.
Now, are you coating the outside of whatever anterior packing material with an antibiotic ointment?
I do that. But again, I think you have to really refer to the manufacturer's recommendations on these various products to do what's optimal for that product.
Lots of pearls there. But the key things, I think, is you need a patient that's happy and sedated if possible. Not too much, but you know, enough to take away the human rights violations. You need to put in that anesthetic and topical vasoconstrictor. And you know, frankly, the best one is cocaine because it does both. But a lot of formularies don't have it because there's sort of a collective freak out about, oh, it's cocaine, it's a drug. And the pharmacy's full of drugs. Anyway, pet peeve. And then also, you need to know your equipment. Everybody has different equipment. It's one of my pet peeves for years is that somebody in the emergency department, in your urgent care, wherever, will have been talking to the beautiful rep that sells the new device, and it might really be a great device. And then they stock your department with it, and it goes in the corner. And then when it comes to using it, neither you nor anybody else knows how to use it. So know your devices, know how to use them. Otherwise, you look like an idiot flipping around there trying to work out this newfangled thing, and you have no idea what you're doing.
Management, part 2.
So I've seen other residents use TXA. I haven't used it before, but I also heard of other topical hemostatics. Do you know how useful they are or what else we could try?
Janelle brings up an excellent point. The use of TXA, which is currently an off-label use for epistaxis, but there is some good data to support this. And while there's not a ton of data, it looks like it may stop the bleeding sooner, have a lower incidence of re-bleeding, and patients are able to be discharged sooner. So how do you actually do this? You take a pledget, you soak it in TXA, and you basically do an anterior pack with this soaked TXA pledget, and you leave it in there until the bleeding stops.
Yeah, actually, I think it's a pretty good idea. I don't think there's much risk to it. And of course, when you keep saying TXA, just to remind everyone, it's tranexamic acid that we're talking about.
Thank you.
We just use a sexy acronym.
I know, it does sound
and
cool.
I think for the patients, Jess, that have bleeding disorders, that you're concerned about one of these underlying issues, it's probably a good idea to do this in advance. It might make the procedure a little bit safer, but the evidence is not solid.
So how do you know if your anterior packing is working?
Well, that's a good question. So that's, of course, the name of the game here is to stop the bleeding. And so after you've put in the anterior packing, it might take a few minutes, actually, until things expand and seal. So don't jump to conclusions right away. Give it a little bit of time. But generally speaking, once that bleeding stops, when they're sitting up, they'll tell you that they no longer feel blood streaming down the back of their throat. You won't see any blood yourself when you look in their throat, and it won't be pouring out the front. And so that's when you've known that it's stopped. And it's probably a good idea in that first area after you insert the nasal tampon to watch them for a while closely to see if what needs to be happening is happening. Is this bleeding stopping?
So let's say we've done one anterior pack on one side, the side that we think is the source of the bleeding, and it hasn't stopped. So going through your algorithmic approach, the next step is?
Well, remember, these are patients that we didn't localize the bleeding. We didn't really see what was going on. We're kind of trying to occlude these areas or tamponade them one after another to rule out any potential source. And so if one nasal tampon hasn't done the trick, a second one goes in the other side. And the combined effect of occluding both spaces, tamponading both spaces, as well as putting that bilateral pressure on the septum, where most of the bleeding is coming from, will often stop the bleeding if it hasn't stopped already.
So if you've got a patient who has a bilateral anterior nasal packing, how is that changing their disposition?
Well, you know what? Everything that I said earlier about the older, vulnerable patient that's got other comorbidities with a single pack, that doubles my concern. Now you've got a patient who can't breathe through their nose at all often. I mean, sometimes they can if they've got the type of pack that has the tube through it, but let's not get into the minutiae. You've got two big things sticking out of the nose and into the posterior pharynx, and it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should underemphasize to people that, it doesn't mean you can't send people home that are young and otherwise healthy, but just be careful about that. It's an airway issue, and sometimes these patients will desat, especially if they've got sleep apnea, these types of things. They need to be observed in a monitored environment.
So in addition to changing their disposition, if they're still bleeding at this point, then what's the next step in your algorithm?
Hopefully, most of your patients are going to stop bleeding if you've got two properly packed anterior nares. But yes, it happens. And remember, about 5% of these, 10% of these bleeds are these dreaded posterior bleeds that might not yet have stopped. And so the technique at this point, getting some help, to be honest, I think that even for people that have been through this several times, it's probably good to start thinking about backup at this point in time. The ENT surgeon is much more likely to get involved and help you out this time acutely. But the algorithm continues that after the double anterior packs don't work, you basically go back to step one. You kind of got to get all that stuff out of there. And then you're going to clean the nose again and do a posterior pack. Because a posterior pack, Jess, can only be placed first before anterior pack. So if you do get down this far into the algorithm, everything does need to come out. And then the first thing that then goes in after that is a posterior pack.
So walk us through the steps for placing a posterior pack.
So posterior pack for me, for most of my career, was basically a Foley catheter, a urinary catheter. And now there's much better and fancier devices that combine both a posterior and an anterior pack. But in its purest form, what a posterior pack is a balloon in the very back of the nasopharynx where it comes together as one, the very posterior aspect of the nasopharyngeal airway. And so after everything comes out, you insert the Foley catheter or equivalent, and you basically put it all the way in. Remember, you're tickling airway at this point. You could be tickling structures that are going to make them hypoxic, and so you've got to think about the airway at this point in time. I want airway equipment at the bedside. I want oxygen. That's important here, monitoring. And then once you put that posterior Foley balloon in, you inflate the balloon something in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 cc's, okay, you're going to put in. And
With air.
Not with saline.
Not saline.
Because then it can, if it ruptures, it drips back into their airway. And you want to gently pull that forward And you're titrating that, actually, Jess. You're titrating it to the stopping of the bleeding. And so you can actually be pulling gently forward with this inflated balloon on the back of their airway. And as you're doing that, you can actually see the blood will stop dripping down the back of their throat. That's ideally how this is done.
That sounds incredibly uncomfortable.
It does. And so one of the things that I always emphasize when I'm talking about this is if you need to intubate a patient, if this is living hell for them and they're bleeding and you're stressed out, it may be a good idea before you get down this far into the algorithm to secure the airway and to sedate the patient so that the rest of this can happen a little more comfortably.
So anyone who's gone down this far in the algorithm is a sick patient. It's someone who you should already be trying to involve ENT or whoever, whichever specialist you have access to where you work. And this is someone who needs to be admitted.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, remember, this patient might have multiple lines. They might have blood products running at the same time. This could be like a 3-alarm fire. And also remember that posterior packing, like we're describing it, is just a temporizing measure. And so in more and more facilities, what we're going to find is that the ENT people are going to come in and do more advanced procedures. They're going to do actual endoscopic ligations of arteries and other advanced procedures that can make things safer for this patient and obviate the need for them to be in this vulnerable situation with all this packing in them.
There's a lot of devices here. We're going to go through them on MRAP HD, but the key things is you've tried all the other things. You tried pinching the nose. You tried getting all the boogers out. You tried doing sort of some cautery of any bleeding points, but you couldn't find any. You packed them anteriorly. None of that worked. Now you're going to pack them posterior. This is a very dangerous situation. Posterior packing is associated with some bad things. It's time for the experts here. So if you're an expert, good. If you're not, get help. And often intubation is required here because this is tickling the airway, as they talked about. And I keep saying packing because I'm old school and it's really you've put in anterior packing devices or you've put in a posterior pressure device or you're going to put in a posterior pressure device. That's what I mean by packing.
So in addition to making the bleeding stop, one of the things we also have to think about is anticoagulation. Is the patient on anticoagulation, as our patient is in this case? So if they're on warfarin, this makes things a lot more simple for us in many ways because we have a therapeutic window, we know what their number should be, and we also have a reversal agent. So if they're having a serious bleed and they are on warfarin, this is someone who you're reversing. If they're sick enough that they're getting a posterior pack or you're transfusing them, they need to be reversed. You're doing vitamin K, you're considering PCC or FFP, depending on what's available to you and the patient's comorbidities. If their INR is elevated, say it's in the 5 to 9 range, but you are able to get the bleeding to stop with an anterior pack, now we're in a gray area. Some hospitals have different protocols for how exactly you manage this. But in general, you want to consider holding their warfarin and rechecking their INR versus possibly lowering their dose and maybe a small dose of vitamin K. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no one size fits all. I mean, you have to consider the patient, their factors involved with why they're on anticoagulation in the first place. How bad is the bleeding? You don't have to reverse every little bleed. But on the other hand, if someone is really bleeding and you can't stop it, it's very difficult to criticize the clinician for reversing whatever they need to reverse.
It's also important to remember that if they are on warfarin and their INR is in the therapeutic window and you can get the bleeding to stop, you're done. You treat this patient like anyone else.
Yeah,
they're on it for a reason.
That's true. And again, there might be some exceptions to that if they live very far away and they're going home and you're a little bit more worried. So, you know, individualize every case. But yes, in general, a lot of people get totally reversed. It didn't have to be if there were minor bleeds that stopped. I agree.
Now we're going to get into an area that's a lot more gray, a lot more uncomfortable, the novel oral anticoagulants.
I think we can start calling them the not so novel anymore.
Not
oral
so
anticoagulants.
Novel. How long did they get that title?
Yeah, exactly. I think that they've abused the privilege of being novel now because it's been several years that we've had these agents, but everyone knows the problems with these agents is that they're wonderful in terms of dosing and convenience and you don't need to monitor them, but some of them are not easy to reverse and that can be very stressful when someone's got ongoing bleeding.
So for most of these, data has yet to show what exactly we should do to reverse them. But in general, with what we know now, if someone is bleeding severely enough that you are going to try to reverse them, the best thing that we know of so far is PCC.
Yes. And of course, that's the, what does that stand for
again? Prothrombin complex concentrate.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, that's something that we would basically try on most patients. It doesn't work on all of them. The other thing is dabigatran, which has been around for longer. Most of these agents actually can be dialyzed off. And so that sometimes is a consideration in these patients. But again, if you get the nosebleed to stop, you're not necessarily altering their coagulation regimen.
Right.
You're not necessarily having to adjust that. And one thing that we didn't mention, in addition to anticoagulant agents, are antiplatelet agents. So that's aspirin and clopidogrel. And those agents, it's a little less clear. We don't really have a good way of reversing those. Certainly, you're not going to continue them on a patient who you're admitting for ongoing bleeding. But you may, in some cases, end up consulting with a hematologist. If it's a really bad case, it won't stop. But, you know, we don't really have good reversals for those, unfortunately.
Special situations.
All right, Jimmy, you are becoming one of the senior residents. You're going to be doing a lot of trauma shifts. Now, someone's having a nosebleed. This raises some questions if they have facial trauma, right?
It does. And if they do have facial trauma and they have facial fractures, is it appropriate to pack them if they're bleeding profusely?
It is important to make a distinction between the spontaneous epistaxis and the traumatic epistaxis. Someone who has severe facial trauma with a Lafort fracture, I could understand people being a little bit worried about putting a big tamponade device or balloon in their nasopharynx. So is that safe to do?
Well, that's a really good question. And I totally agree. You've got to take things more seriously when there's been trauma. This is going to affect more vessels that are bleeding than the ones that we've just talked about. And if it's an emergency, you have no choice. If it's an emergency and the patient is bleeding out, you do have to go ahead and try to pack that nose. There is more concerns here about whether the fracture extends into their cranium, and everyone's always heard of the risk of sticking a tampon into the brain if you think there's an unstable fracture. So if you can get away without doing anything and the patient is stable and you can get all the experts to the bedside, trauma surgery, ENT, that kind of thing, that's great. But if they're bleeding out and you've got no options, you may need to pack a nose in the case of trauma. These cases, as I said, are more complicated, and they might often need to go to interventional radiology to embolize a different set of vessels than would be with just a normal non-traumatic nosebleed.
Excellent. So in dire circumstances, do it.
Yes.
Okay. Now, another thing that was mentioned by one of the residents right up front was hypertension. Because all of our consultants are going to ask us about the patient's blood pressure and ask that we control the patient's blood pressure. But when you look at the literature on this, yeah, there is an increased incidence in patients who have hypertension in having epistaxis, but it's not necessarily a causal relationship, and there's not really a clear benefit in treating their blood pressure.
I think I can bring a little bit of clarity to this, Jess, which is that, yes, hypertension is ultimately the cause of some of these very bad nosebleeds, because chronic hypertension can be the source of vascular injury that results in posterior nosebleeds. So yes, that's true, but that doesn't translate to we need to get the blood pressure down acutely in one of these episodes, because the blood pressure is probably more a reflection of their pain and anxiety around this episode. Probably when we actually treat the nosebleed, the blood pressure will get better to some degree. So it's not really a hypertensive emergency. So the real concern here, Jess, is that the sicker these patients are, the ones that are really hemorrhaging bad, they're going into hypovolemic shock. If we give patients like that antihypertensive medications, we might be taking the bottom out from under them.
That's the last thing that you want to do.
Right.
Let that blood pressure be high. Be happy about it.
I think so. I think you treat it with analgesics. I think you treat it with pain medicines. Because if you treat it with something like a long-acting beta blocker, then you might be in a situation where a patient in shock can't mount the response to shock because you've downgraded their adrenergic response. So we're not really big fans of antihypertensives in these situations. We really like anxiolytics. We like anti-pain. We like sedation. But really, it's not a hypertensive emergency.
Yeah, that is maybe more treating the consultant than the patient.
Cannot tell you how many times you have to talk to the consultants about this. They see a hypertensive patient who's got a blood nose, and they say, you know, treat it. Forget the fact that the patient is anxious because there's blood pouring out of their nose and that's why they're a bit hypertensive. No, no. The way you treat this is you give them analgesia and you make them feel better and you stop the bleeding. And then if they're hypertensive, they need chronic therapy. In the acute setting, they don't need their blood pressure dumped by you. No good.
The final thing I think we need to cover in management is epistaxis in kids. So what's different, Stuart, from everything we've talked about so far? How is it different to treat kids?
Well, I guess the good news is that kids don't usually have these really life-threatening types of bleeds. They don't tend to have these posterior bleeds that we're so worried about. You know, if they do, they might have some congenital abnormality and it might be alarming, but the vast majority, it's not an issue. And the other thing I would mention is that because kids stick so many things in so many places, that something that you should think about is foreign body. And so a good examination and history for foreign body is important, because a certain percentage of them are just going to be from that. And that's what causes repeated nosebleeds in a lot of kids.
They squirted some Afrin, I think, Afrin in my nose. And then they put this balloon thing in my right nostril.
What's that feel like when they put it in? Is it painful?
It's sort of, yes.
Is it hurt or is it uncomfortable or what does it feel like?
Uncomfortable. Yeah, it was uncomfortable.
Yeah, so we've watched her for 2 hours. So we think she can go home and she should probably stay on the Lovenox.
Okay, you want to keep her on it.
Yeah, I mean, she's on Lovenox because she had a PE. So risk-benefit here, she should probably stay on the Lovenox.
And we'll give her some antibiotics and have her follow up in a couple days.
Okay, that sounds good. That sounds fair.
Disposition and summary.
So patients who you think it's safe enough for them to go home, if they have an anterior pack in place, we're generally telling them that they need to come back within 1 to 3 days. So I tell them 2 because 2's between 1 and 3.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Actually, it used to be longer and we've sort of shortened this over time, this sort of period that they have to have the nasal tampon in for. And the other thing is that there's a lot of arguments and controversy in the literature about whether or not they need prophylactic antibiotics. I just give them because, you know, the last thing in the world you want is a toxic shock syndrome, even though if it's pretty rare. So we give them PO antibiotics as prophylaxis. We make arrangements for them to come back in about 2 days. And that could be to a primary care provider's office if they're comfortable, or it could be to an ENT surgeon. It depends on what's most convenient and appropriate for that patient.
Maybe to say it a bit more explicitly, the concept of prophylactic antibiotics for that anterior nasal pack is that you've got this anterior nasal pack in there with blood and you're blocking the sinuses. And there is the potential for bugs to get in there to replicate and to produce things like toxic shock syndrome, a staph or a strep syndrome, multiplying, you know, producing lots of toxin, and could be bad. It's rare, as stated, some people give prophylactic antibiotics in the hope of preventing that. Not sure if it works.
A lot of patients, we just bring them back to the ED. You know, if you don't have great follow-up for the patient, just bring them back. We're comfortable with this. We'll remove the pack. And there's also some art and science to removing the nasal pack. So you don't just, you know, deflate the balloon and yank it out. You want to do this in a way that's not damaging to the epithelium, that's not uncomfortable for the patient. And also you want to make sure they don't re-bleed. So if they have a balloon device in place, you're going to deflate that balloon and you're going to wait. You're going to wait and make sure that the bleeding doesn't start again before you pull it out. And you're usually going to moisten whatever the product is so it's more comfortable on removal.
Yeah, and probably in that sort of peri-removal time, it's good to keep a close eye on them for the next half hour or so afterwards to make sure that they're comfortable and that they don't need additional treatment and that things really have resolved.
And finally, if you are the provider who's removing the packing, once it's out, please go back and look at their nasopharynx again, because you don't know how much bleeding there was when that was inserted and how good of a look the initial provider got at the nasopharynx. So they could have easily missed something that you now have the opportunity to see and get them to the right follow-up care. So we covered a ton of ground, but I think hopefully we gave people a stepwise approach to epistaxis.
Yeah, I really like the stepwise approach. And remember, always with our algorithmic stepwise approach, if things aren't going your way, just keep going back to the beginning and start over again.
Summary.
Do you want to distinguish yourself as an emergency medicine clinician? Do you want to be one of those people that everybody's calm around because they know you got some skills up in yourself? Well, one of the disorders that you can get really good at is epistaxis, because so many are not good at it. So let's try and do the summary. Quick history. How long have you had the bleeding? How frequent? How much? Any trauma? Finger versus fist? What medications are you on, particularly the bleeding medications like the Coumadins? Do you have a bleeding disorder, for example? Does this keep happening? Maybe there is an undiagnosed bleeding disorder. Then you've got to get to the exam, usual exam, but then into the nose. So blow out all of those boogers. You're going to need a really good light. You're going to need a nasal speculum. Get all those boogers out, and then maybe shove up there some oxymetazolone and maybe some cocaine plegets, which will both, you know, give you some anesthesia and some constriction. And while you're doing all this, you get them to pinch their anterior part of their nose, the soft part, hard, firmly, for 10 or 15 minutes. Now, if you find a bleeding part in that anterior part in Little's area, then you can cauterize it with silver nitrate, cautery, only on one side of the septum. And be careful, because you can burn all the way through, but if you've got a bleeding site, try and go all the way around it to knock it off. Trying to burn right on top of it often will fail. If that doesn't work, then you have to pack with one of a variety of sort of nasal tampon devices, and often we'll pack bilaterally in this case in order to try and stop the bleeding. If that works fine, then you're going to discharge them home, and you give them some antibiotics, and you bring them back in 2 or 3 days, and you're going to pull them out. But if that fails, anterior pack, and they're still bleeding a lot, you might have a posterior bleed here, and now you've got an airway problem as well as an exsanguination problem. This is sort of big boy, big girl stuff, Now you need to be thinking about, do I need to address this airway? Do I need to intubate the patient? And you certainly need to think about that before you put in one of these posterior nasal packs. You don't always have to, but you often have to, because the airway is right there. And in all of these patients, give them something for pain, give them some anxiolysis. And sometimes, as we've said, in the bad ones, in the posterior ones that are big, you might have to go all the way and paralyze, intubate, and get busy. And for the sick patients, you have to start thinking about calling a friend. And those friends are ENT, obviously. And sometimes that friend is an interventional radiologist, because these posterior bleeds cannot be stopped with anything less than some blowing up of balloons and stopping of bleeding vessels that only interventional radiology can do. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, be a star, be a legend, get good at epistaxis from the minor to the severe. Check out MRAP HD for some videos of the kind of toys that you'll need. But you can do this. You got this. You'll be a star. You'll go real far. You'll play the guitar. My name's Mel Herbert. That was Jess Mason, Stuart Swadron, the Super Ocho, the fantastic patients of the University of California, San Francisco, Fresno program. We thank them all.